Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Horrible Podcast. I'm Brian.
I'm Tyler.
And I'm Drew.
And I just want to say, if you're looking for us on social media, we are Horrible PCast on Twitter, HorrorBullPcast. And everywhere else, we're The Horrible Podcast. Our website's thehorriblepodcast.com, Facebook, we're The Horrible Podcast, Google Plus, if that's what you're into, The Horrible Podcast. If you're looking for us on Stitcher or iTunes, The Horrible Podcast. How many times do I have to say it?
The Horrible Podcast.
Okay. Horrible Podcast. Can you hear us, Tyler?
You cut out for a second, but it's fine.
All right. If you're going to do a little editing. So I unplugged the Ethernet. Now you sound 100 times better than you did when we were just on the Ethernet. What is going on, technology?
Technology is bad.
Yeah. Yes, we love technology, but not as much as you we see, always and forever.
What is that?
It's a dated reference, a little Napoleon Dynamite reference.
Napoleon Dynamite.
Oh. It's a Kip.
It is Kip and La Shonda. Yeah.
We've watched a movie, and I always want to talk about the movie that we're talking about, but this week especially, I want to talk about the movie that we watched because I thought it was awesome.
I agree with you. I thought
Only Lovers Left Alive. Sorry, we didn't say it.
Yes, Only Lovers Left Alive. Jim Jarmusch's little
Moody
vampire flick.
Moody vampire indie epic.
I kept laughing at the idea of it saying it's just like two sensitive vampires. Which now that I think about saying that, I guess it's true. I mean, the touching thing. They're sensitive.
I had like the worst experience ever trying to watch this movie. So
why?
Kind of colored it for me. So
that's I want to hear about it. What was?
I mean, it's not even an interesting story in that regard. It's internet woes, technology, arg.
You kept tripping over and falling and knocking over, like turning off your computer, and it just kept hitting the power button, and you couldn't watch the movie.
That would be much more entertaining. No, it just kept cutting in and out, every five. 6-7 minutes or something. So we had to keep starting it again and starting it again. It's like, oh my God, it took like an extra 30 minutes to watch. It was.
Well, you know, I think that when it comes to this whole like digital versus, a real movie theater kind of thing, the debate that goes on, I think a lot of people forget, especially the studios, that not everyone has access to amazing internet access.
To Google Fiber.
Right. Like, They fail to remember that a lot of the world still operates on like 6 Mbps.
A lot of the world doesn't have internet.
I'm at 12 kilobytes a second. 12. Yeah, I'm at 1 Mbps.
Not everyone's an early adopter. So it's, my parents have faster internet than I do just because they happen to live in a place that has Verizon fiber. So, they can't. Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Their Facebook pages load instantly faster.
Brian, I haven't looked at Farmville in a while, but last time I did, it ran really quick.
It was a 60 frames a second.
Let's just say that there's no lag, and when I come into a multiplayer, I get first choice of vehicles because my computer's fastest.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
I had a similarly difficult experience. The Apple TV in the house is too far away from the router, so the internet doesn't work well enough to just mirror or Apple TV streaming stuff. So we got about a minute in and it was working. I was crossing my fingers because we were cooking dinner and I had to hurry and I was hoping it would work. So I was like, oh, please just fucking work, please God. But a minute in, it just paused and just spinning wheel over and over again.
I like to think that you, your cooking dinner is equivalent to John Travolta and Kira Sedgwick's haircutting scene in Phenomenon.
I've never seen that movie.
That's a deep cut for you guys.
I've never seen that movie.
Well, let's just say it was like a shitty 90s music video.
After Pulp Fiction, I expected him to be in all awesome movies. And then that came out. I was like, I guess that was just a short-lived dream. Because it was Pulp Fiction. I was like, fuck yeah. There was Pulp Fiction, and then there was Broken Arrow, and I was like, fuck yeah.
Yeah,
because Broken Arrow was awesome.
And then there was Michael, and then there was Phenomenon. I don't know if that's the exact order, but those are the movies that were coming later.
I think Michael came.
I worked at a vet clinic at the time when Phenomenon came out, and I remember one of the veterinarians going, Brian, that's going to be the best movie of the summer.
God.
That's John Turtletaub.
And it was also a huge Scientology kind of thing, too. Like, it was in Scientology infused.
Well, certainly.
Was he
Battleship Earth, guys? How about that?
He became a clear Yeah. So I liked Pulp Fiction, but not all John Travolta in the 90s.
And you know what else you liked?
That's fair.
Only Lovers Left Alive. Let's get into it. Drew, give us a brief history of all of Jim Jarmusch's films.
All of them. We're gonna lean back. Just we want a fireside chat version of this.
Take you on a oral AURAL journey of Jim Jarmusch's collected works.
It goes back to 1984. Yeah. Down by Law. Was Down by Law Jim Jarmusch?
Think so. Strangers in Paradise or Stranger mm-hmm. in Paradise was the first big one that I remember hearing about and talking about. I don't think I ever saw it though. Like the first one I really remember where I really understood who he was or that was Dead Man with Johnny Depp mm-hmm. and with Ghost Dog,
Way
of the Samurai, and then he was supposed to break it big with Broken Flowers. That was supposed to be his big breakthrough, and then that didn't happen.
Right.
No, this was supposed to be his next one, and that didn't really happen either. It's like, I don't know why we think he's actually going to break through. He's not. I mean, his movies aren't openly accessible to everyone. Like, this one was really good, and ultimately I liked it, even with all the problems I had watching it. Just made it a painful experience to watch, but it didn't leave me with a bad taste in my mouth, although I have some minor complaints.
You didn't taste blood in your mouth?
No, I did not.
Is one of your main complaints the word lovers?
No.
God, I hate that word.
No, that wasn't.
Why?
It. I don't like when someone refers to someone else as a lover. I'm like, oh, just hurt. I don't know. I have a real,
negative reaction to that. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Lover. What? I think it's mostly the way people say it.
Maybe it's
hello, lover.
That, and maybe it's the Saturday Night Live sketch with Will Ferrell and Rachel Dratch. The when my lover rubs grease on me and licks it off. That's probably what it is.
I like that was like your really bad Hannibal Lecter impersonation. When my lover rubs grease on me. And
when you're eating your lover.
And rubs it off.
Yeah, Down by Law was Jim Jarmusch. I watched Stranger Than Paradise, but Down by Law was the one I really remember.
Than Paradise, the Dana Carvey, John Lovitz movie when they get Nick Cage when they get trapped into the town?
It's Trouble in Paradise.
Oh,
Down by Law had I
really
when I first realized how much I really liked Tom Waits, I was like, oh, he's an actor too. So I watched Down by Law, and actually I came to really know who Jim Jarmusch was because I read that book Spike, Mike, Slackers, and Dykes that was about the 90s movie, and they talked that book talked a lot about Jim Jarmusch and his influence on indie cinema. Like Kevin Smith is heavily influenced by Jim Jarmusch, I think.
Yeah, go check out Coffee and Cigarettes too if you have not.
Is that a sequel to?
No.
Which one's the sequel
200
to?
200 Cigarettes.
No.
Coffee and Cigarettes is a sequel to 200 Cigarettes, the ensemble movie from the late 90s, early 2000s.
The with a special guest appearance by Elvis Costello. I'm sorry, that's the least notable person in that movie, but for some reason I latched onto that.
The scene with Bill Murray is really fantastic in there.
In Coffee and Cigarettes, not.
Not Only Lovers. So Only Lovers Left Alive, Tilda Swinton, who I'm not...
The scenes with John Hurt were really awesome.
Yes, they were. Tilda Swinton, who I'm not completely convinced isn't a vampire.
She's one of the strangest looking people.
But you're drawn into her. Like, there's something about her that just makes you, like, pulls you into her. And she's an amazing actress. I mean, she does a great job in everything she's in.
Loved her in Snowpiercer.
Yeah, she was amazing in Snowpiercer. Have you seen Snowpiercer yet? Mm-hmm. Well, it's available for you on Dropbox anytime.
She is like the word evocative comes to mind, but that's not. I don't think that's the word I'm looking for. But
provocative?
No.
Invocative?
It has a cative in it probably somewhere. Like she alluring maybe. Like there's something about her even in Burn After Reading. There was something about her I really love. There's just like she seems like someone you would date just so she would shit on you all of the time, like metaphorically.
Really shit on you? Oh,
just kind of like very harsh, sort of like Ice Queen, sort of like, you know, I'm gonna leave you if you just
my
don't do what I say.
My first experience with Tilda Swinton was the beach.
Really, mine was Orlando, Sally Potter's Orlando.
Right, but the beach really like, she was just very cold. And have you seen when you talk about
she's
Kevin
in there?
Yes. Oh, yeah. I love that movie.
She plays the part of the mom in that movie amazingly.
Right.
I don't know if I agree with everything. I loved the book, and I don't know if I agree with everything that happens on all the other people in them. Like, I didn't see John C. Reilly as the father is dumb and affable as John C. Reilly, but she played that disconnected.
Perfectly.
Yeah, yeah, she fit the mom's idea of what I had thought the mom was perfectly. Yeah,
she was perfect.
Just the scene where the baby won't stop crying, so she takes him out next to the jackhammer and is just like sitting there because at least next to there she doesn't hear the baby screaming the entire time. That's the scene that I sort of think about when I think about that movie. Or the like the kid shitting his pants and just staring at the mom like, I fucking hate you. It's awful.
Or the one where he shits his pants and then she leaves the room and he wipes it all over her maps. Whole day.
That movie's good. Also watch We Need to Talk About Kevin. That's also a great movie.
Yeah. Right at the beginning, a good line where Tom Hiddleston makes a comment about seeing like, oh man, when I saw that guy play and what's his name? Anton Yelchin goes, you saw him play on YouTube.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the best parts of this movie for me was the idea that they had been around so long to influence all these scientists and, really creative people to do their thing, and they were still using like the technology that they'd helped. Like they were using like Tesla's coils and stuff like that to power the house and stuff like that. I really did like that, and the fact that John Hurt was Christopher Marlowe.
Yeah.
So
this Only Lovers Left Alive is just proof that Jim Jarmusch can make a really fantastic movie, and one that I wish more. One of the things that in doing this podcast I've sort of come to lament about the genre is that I wish more movies were able to just be about the tone and the mood rather than like other things that don't quite work. A lot of the filmmakers we've seen have not been able to pull off just the mood and tone and let that drive the movie. And this Only Lovers Left Alive has the perfect tone and is driven by the soundtrack and the score and the acting. And it's not really, there's something vaguely horrific about it, but it's not a traditional horror movie in that way. It's just so moody and great. And it almost feels like Tom Hiddleston was like, he had this weird, like, Kurt Cobain quality about him that just was amazing.
He totally did. Like, the idea of him just sitting, so he sits around in his house to make this perfect music that he's been making for hundreds of years.
Yeah, centuries.
Centuries that, but he has to change it up so nobody catches on that it's him doing it. And just the level of frustration that must come with being a creative person and realizing that you can't continue to make your music and call it your own because people will know you're a vampire then.
I mean, I think you hit on an interesting point just a second ago, Tyler. Though I think it's quite arguable that it's not a horror movie at all.
Yeah.
I really don't think when it comes down to it that it is. And that's still, I guess, that's one of my ultimate ultimate complaint about it was that it's why I also thought it was cool because I'm tired of vampire movies to some degree, but I thought the vampire as just kind of the blood addict was kind of, I was like, why make them vampires at that point? Kind of as well in that regard. But although I still found the movie interesting in that regard, it was almost, that part seemed unnecessary. It just kind of, it was like, oh great. So it's a movie about, it's an indie movie about, drugged out rock stars to some degree.
Right.
That are hundreds of years old.
We chose it because of the fact that they were vampires and it was two high profile people, Tom Hiddleston and Tilda Swinton playing vampires.
I can never remember her name. I'm so glad you guys brought it up. When I was trying to describe this movie to Kate, I kept going like, it's the sort of redheadish, like severe looking lady. She was like, Julianne Moore? Who are you talking about? I was like, no, she was in Burn After Reading. She was like, I haven't seen that.
So in my mind, I want to get her and Kate Blanchett like mixed up all the time.
Oh, really?
But they don't look anything alike. Mm-mm. But for some reason, like their intensity or something is.
They are intense. Also, really good actresses.
Yes,
like in the Venn diagram, they share that middle part. Drew, that's an interesting assertion that this is just blood is like a metaphor for like the whole movie is a metaphor about sort of addiction, whether it's love or music or drugs or which is blood in this. So it is kind of about that, but the mood is so heavy about this movie that like it's a really dark, dark drama.
Dork.
Oh, yeah. Dork. It's a dork drama. So I think like that that is the thing that carries me through on this movie, where I can say, like, I can see this as sort of a horror movie without feeling like I'm, you know, playing the audience or something, or like that we're just picking this because we want to see this movie, which is almost kind of true.
And, you know, also what made this movie so amazing was the fan-fucking-tastic soundtrack. Like, the music that goes through the rest of the whole movie. Even, you know, at the end when they go back to Tanzania and that woman is singing in that bar, that was just, like, that song was... Tangiers, I'm sorry. That song was just so hypnotic. Like, I didn't want it to be over.
The whole score for me was really on point, where especially the drum, like the just sort of like sparse drum kind of thing that was going on. This movie harkens back to the 90s in a way that makes me really miss it. Not in a nostalgia kind of way, but the style and grace of this movie. And also the sort of like the way that the characters behave is almost way more reminiscent of the way that people thought about things in the 90s. Like the sort of melancholia that we don't see today. Like we don't see it as much today. Like that sort of tortured artist stuff. Like it, if you look at all the people who are sort of distraught or like hooked on drugs who are also artists, they are manic, but they are not depressive. And so I sort of yearn for the 90s depressive artist who is like, they do drugs because they feel like almost like something missing in their soul. Whereas today it's like,
they just want to feel something.
Yeah. And Tom Hiddleston embodies that sort of like 90s rock star aesthetic. So this movie is like 20 years too late.
And I was going to mention this, Drew just also pointed it out, but the group that does most of the score is a group called Squirrel, which Jim Jarmusch is a member. Like, that's his band. And
he's
very
so
like
cool.
Explosions in the sky, Sigur Rós kind of sound to them, this atmospheric guitar where you even see in the movie Hiddleston's playing the guitar with the drumstick, which is something that Jonesy from Sigur Rós does in like concert. He'll play his guitar with a bow or a drumstick while he's playing. So it was really, I enjoyed that aspect of it too. Like just to see him create.
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking the same 90s thing, even in my criticism a minute ago. I mean, the vampire as a drug addict is a very 90s idea of a way to kind of have played them as well. And I mean, I think there's a lot of this that does feel like it is colored through that 90s lens, which is a good thing. Independent cinema in the 90s was worth it. You know?
Well, and too, like the way when they drink the blood, how they react to it too. It's not like a life
force.
Yeah,
it's a high.
They get high off the blood.
I love that scene when these sort of overhead shots of them leaning back on the couches and just in a heroin induced euphoria.
I want that feeling.
It was pretty amazing. And
I don't do heroin tonight. I'm doing it.
God.
40 years old, I can't get addicted now.
Just can't have it. Philosophically, this movie kind of shares the ennui of something like Interview with the Vampire, which I really liked as a sort of concept. And I thought that Interview with a Vampire was more kinetic than this movie. It had more movement. But Brad Pitt's character in Interview was a lot more sort of like contemplative. And this movie is just, it is all contemplation. It's just sort of like you sort of drown in the scenery and the like. It's such about a place, even if that place is Detroit, that it's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's absolutely gorgeous to watch and very much the trailer I think is weirdly misleading. Is it all the scenes that happen in the trailer happen in the movie, but the way the trailer's cut is they all happen with a very different energy, a very much lower key energy. The trailer seems to promise something more, at least those scenes differently. It's weird because when they play over the movie, I didn't react to them the same way as I actually did in the trailer. Like the same things that when Jeffrey Wright jumps at him when he just kind of appears to get the blood.
Yeah, right.
Like that scene, it plays exactly the same in the movie, but in the trailer, it pops in a weirdly different way. It's strange. I think that was one of my issues with it might be the trailer had me weirdly excited for a slightly different movie, even though everything that I expected from the trailer was there. It's strange.
A slightly more menacing movie. And like odd, the movie was not as odd as I expected it to be.
They, yeah, and yeah, and that like it's like they, they had figured out a way to exist without having to kill people. Because it seems like to them that would just be like that would just be such a drag.
Well, what they said, yeah. I mean, I feel like what they said at the end is it's very what 15th century or something when they actually decided to kill those people.
And you know, there's
like,
a lot
like,
of
oh, that's so.
And we get a lot of like, stuff that's alluded to as well, like the idea that when she's saying like there's a flight through London, he shakes his head no, like they can't go back to London because someone would obviously find them. And even when they as soon as she gets back into the United States, her sister shows up.
Right.
Like they can feel each other from miles away, and the idea that what was it? I was gonna say shit.
They can feel each other, and the idea that they can.
I knew what I was saying. I just lost my train of thought.
I was trying to recapture it for you.
I thought it was pretty. I thought Mia Wasikowska is as Tilda Swinton's sister is a nicely brilliant bit of
you
bit
drank
of casting.
Ian.
And if you want to talk about it,
I love that scene.
A strange Hitchcockian thriller verging on horror to check out would be Stoker.
Stoker is a great movie.
I've never seen that.
Which also stars the guy who I thought was Tom Hiddleston in the previews.
Matthew Good?
Yeah, I was like, is that Tom Hiddleston? Oh, that's not Tom Hiddleston.
Yeah. I kept on thinking it was Lee Pace. And yeah, until I knew it was Tom Hiddleston.
Right.
So.
Who played the little girl in Interview with a Vampire? It's
Kirsten Dunst.
Kirsten Dunst. Her sister is reminds me of the Kirsten Dunst character. That's where this is kind of like an Interview with the Vampire. Like this is the impetuous vampire who can't quite master.
And she became a vampire when she was too young.
Yeah.
And like that was Kirsten Dunst's problem is that she was going to be a Claudia. She's going to be a.
She was a grown woman.
A grown woman in a 12-year-old kid kid's body.
Yeah.
And so I found the movie to be fairly monotone as far as its tone, and that provided a little sort of spark that was a little different from the sort of like brooding, just kind of like cool rock star vibe that the whole movie had. So it provided a different play on things, and the movie sort of like bordered on becoming like too cool for itself, and this added something to it that I really dug because she was the like. Tilda Swinton and Tom Hiddleston's characters were so measured and like cool, and they weren't going to make major mistakes. Having this character who represents chaos show up made the movie infinitely more interesting. And I almost would have liked to have seen her a little bit earlier in the movie to see how she could have wrought more chaos,
or not, and not be dismissed as quickly.
Yeah. And just sort of like kicked out on her ass.
Now,
nobody wanted anything to do with her though. That was the thing.
Even her sister
wanted her out of there.
She was like the your average like just crazy little sister like family member that shows up and you're like, oh shit.
I think part of them were glad that she drained Ian, so they had a reason to get rid of her.
Yeah.
True. As much as they hated that happened.
And like also Hiddleston was kind of hinting at he knew that Ian was like selling him out. Like he gave him the record and stuff like they saw that record being sold.
Like it kinda had to happen almost like he expected and knew that it would have to happen. Because Kate and I were watching that part talking about well, what's going to happen? Are they going to kill Ian or are they going to kill the sister after the sister kills Ian? Like, what is going to happen? And I kind of like that Jarmusch introduces the bullet and the gun and then doesn't have it pay off. Like, intentionally sidestepping that old movie trope. I kind of love that because I expected the bullet at any point and it never happened. And it seemed intentional.
I did think one of them was going to die, or they were going to use it on the sister.
I thought after Tom Hiddleston's guitar was destroyed, I certainly would think about shooting someone if they killed him.
The 1905 Gibson.
So yeah, I expected him to just sort of like fly into a rage, and like we get to see the vampire in him come out, but we didn't. And I almost kind of respect the movie for that, like that it is so restrained in a way that like I just kind of respect that it never says like, well, here's a horror moment to make it some other thing. I really like that.
And despite all of Hiddleston's, Hiddleston made the most 90s comment of all when he said, "Despite all my rage, I'm still just a rat in a cage."
Despite all my rage.
The world is a vamp. I am a vamp.
It's better to burn out than to fade away.
He did not say that.
There can be only one. He didn't say that?
No.
That was a different movie. Sorry.
We're not being very funny tonight. I just realized that.
You're not being very funny. Well, this movie is very moody. Like, we're fitting the mood. We're being
cool.
I
didn't get his I liked her passport
you
name.
Make it funny?
Daisy Buchanan.
Yeah.
And
what was his name?
He was Stephen Daedalus.
Okay,
so that brings us to my major problem with this movie is that it is so cool. Like, this movie is so utterly cool that I don't feel like it needed as many references to things as it did. Like, they weren't sophisticated references to things either. They're things that, like, anyone who's taken eighth grade English understands almost. And also, I felt like the sort of like speechifying about history and scientists and doctors, like, it felt way too political and of the moment, and like politically charged about how Jim Jarmusch feels about the way that people view science now versus like people who had been around for hundreds of years probably would not be as riled up as he makes his characters, because it seems to be like him speaking through those characters.
Well, they made the Jack White comment. I was like, that was an odd comment.
Yeah, like
his house. And then I thought of things like, well, are they trying to say that he's a vampire? Like, were they kind of maybe making a reference like it was a vampire?
Ah, maybe.
Yeah. He does look exactly like Tom Hiddleston.
That's what I thought too. Is like, well, Jack White could be a vampire.
And there's that really weird thing at that baseball game a few weeks ago, and when Jack White looked so weird at it, so unhappy.
I enjoyed that.
It was almost like seeing Stephen King at the Red Sox game, just reading a novel in the stands, just like.
He loves baseball. That's so weird that he wouldn't actually go and watch the game.
Yeah.
Doesn't he do Stephen a baseball King. Commentary like on like a Bangamain station?
Probably.
I'm
yeah.
sure I mean, he does. He wrote a book.
Books. Yeah.
That's right. You're right.
He wrote a book about the World Series win finally. So I saw
they're really beating that dead horse, aren't they?
It's kind of it is kind of a like love letter to decay and like Detroit as a metaphor for like the decaying of society. Like he picks this place that was once great but now no one really cares about and shows it as this sort of thing. And if we talked much longer, we could draw out the comparisons between Detroit and like society as a whole and how he thinks about it, how Tom Hiddleston's character thinks about it, but I can't actually make the connections right now between
those
two.
And he made a comment in passing to Tilda Swinton. I think I can't remember when it was close to the end about the whole, he's like, have the water war started yet? Are they still fighting over oil?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. So political
and
stuff.
It made me think about just the idea that they know what's coming. It's just, you know, they're so out of it, they don't know where they're at yet in time.
And so I think that's one of my problems is that seems more like an attributable comment to like, if we were all alive for hundreds of years, we would be much more out of touch with society and be looking at the bigger picture and we wouldn't be as sort of like pettily involved in all of these things like science and holding these grudges over things. And like, as much as I love the 90s influence of this, at points I had to, like, it wasn't eye-rolling, but I also was like, okay, come on. Really, like, you're tired of the zombies, and so, because they don't believe in evolution. Even though I also am tired of it, I'm, you know, I'm also only 30.
Well, it took me a couple minutes to realize that maybe, because I knew that, isn't it vampires that have ghouls like Renfield and stuff like that? They're the guys that they... like
minions,
kind of string along
they're
make,
minions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're minions. So when they said that at first, I thought Ian was just a minion that he was talking about as a zombie. But turns out he's just a huge
super
fan.
That's just what he calls people.
Right, he just called people zombies. But I thought that was good that they still added, like, they still had to find his minion to do his bidding during the day.
Right, yeah. I mean, that's still the idea, yeah. He just has to pay them in this
ungodly amounts of money.
He doesn't. Yeah. He doesn't glamour them or something like in True Blood or something.
I mean, I would. I feel like if someone gave me that kind of money, bought me a nice car, I'd probably keep my mouth shut about them because I wouldn't want anybody else getting in on the deal.
Yeah, so you're horning in territory, man.
That's right, man.
So do you think he just sensed that Ian would still?
I think he did. I think he knew Ian would probably sell him out.
All right. Do we need?
I'm sure that's not the first.
Yeah. Sure.
Do we ever get? I paid attention, but I don't know if we ever got an indication of like why Tilda Swinton was far away from him for so long. Was it to be with John Hurt? Like what? Just to hang out with him? Like what? Why did they start off in two locations?
Well, that
you can answer this. I'm pretty sure they're married. They've been married for hundreds of years.
She's just taking 50 years off.
Yeah. I shook my head in the affirmative during that part. I was like, I get it.
I get it.
I get it.
I get it.
No, but maybe, and I think that may be it too. Is like, well, they're going to be together forever.
I mean, they what probably is, were tired of each other.
Like, what is 10, what is 10, 15 years to someone who lives hundreds of years?
I would imagine her character was tired of him to some degree because all he wants to do is sit in this apartment and mope and make this music. And she seemed to, I mean, look, even if you look at their color scheme kind of deal where she's so light to his dark kind of deal, like that's she probably still wanted to do stuff, even if it was just be out and about in the world. I imagine she'd been traveling the world and lighted in Tangiers. Yeah. Marlowe's there. She's like, cool, I'll hang out with this dude.
He is supposed to be the Christopher Marlowe, because at one point when she's focusing in on
Kit,
his...
which is his nickname anyway.
And his when they kind of like go through his Tom Hiddleston's wall of friends, you see like Shakespeare, it focuses in really closely on Christopher Marlowe. So.
Well, yeah, I mean, and it validates the whole theory that Marlowe wrote Shakespeare stuff. It seems to be behind that idea.
And that he got arrested for heretical like writings. That's what he was wanted for, and he just disappeared.
He died. Marlowe got stabbed in the eye during a card game.
Oh, did he?
Yeah. But they believe that he was killed by members of the Vatican, because he did say some pretty heretical things, but he basically infiltrated the church, and then, or maybe it wasn't the Vatican, maybe it was the Church of England. But either way, he was stabbed in the eye during a card game or during like a bar brawl of some kind, and that's how he died. But they think that he was killed by two people from one of the major churches.
They were there as grifters.
They were. It brings about that whole, like, people who believe in the Illuminati stuff, they're like, oh, it's part of that, like, world domination stuff. But as far as I like the idea that she's light and he's dark, and it's the yin-yang idea of the different energies. And I could see that this movie also represents a very classical idea of what is cool. And, like, if you're hanging out in Tangiers, like, that's... That it is reminiscent of some very specific literature, namely the lost generation of, you know, your Hemingways and like all of those people. They seem to write novels about those kinds of places, and so I find all of that interesting. That the Jarmusch is so like seemingly not classically trained in this sort of stuff, but he manages to find a way to bring all these like loose threaded cool things together into one piece of film, and I actually really loved that about the movie.
Oh, there you go.
No, there we go.
No, I think it's no. I think that you've summed it up with the word. I mean, it's a cool movie.
Yeah, I get. Yeah, it is. It feels like a movie that you if you don't get it, then you know something's wrong with you, kind of things.
I could see people from my hometown going like, "This movie's really slow." I don't see what it's good
and
about it.
I was worried about the length, as I usually am.
It's a really long credits, is what it has.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a 156, and it's a 203 movie. That's a long credit sequence.
That's like
it seemed to, it moved fine. It moved at a fine pace. Like, I was completely fine with everything that was going on, and I agree with Tyler. Like, I felt like I wanted my, like, that youthful, like, angst back of, like, oh, God, why is everything... Well, not youthful angst. I feel like this every day of, like,
you have mangst now.
I have mangst. Why is it all suck so bad?
I also think the movie does... it's a really good movie in that it doesn't do anything desperate to make it itself interesting. All of the things that occur in the plot, the plot developments are sort of naturally occurring within the universe, and it never does anything to like spike the movie. Like, we have to do this here, which I think is really hard to pull off. In that way, it's almost a literary movie in that it doesn't do anything drastic. It doesn't do anything like really strange. The shift at the end, I thought I was like, why are we moving places? But in the end, as we see how they're sort of transitioning to a new place in life, or death, or whatever, that it was necessary. That, like, oh, they just move on is kind of what they do. Like, they have to move on whenever something happens. And I like that they have this event with someone they know. Like, it's not their own destruction. It's not people who bring it about, but it's one of their own, just family who does it. It's interesting. Well,
that begs the question, were they becoming parents at the end?
What do you mean?
I mean, they were about to create these vampires. They're about to turn that couple into vampires.
Oh,
was
right.
The next kind of their next stage. They were siring.
Is that what they were doing? Were they just feeding?
Well, they said they were going to turn them though.
Oh,
that's what they said. turning, you know, another couple, have another, you know, couple like them that was now becoming.
Yeah. Oh, right.
But like I said, we don't really see in this world what vampire and their, you know, the people they turn, how they have relationships. In lots of these vampire worlds, they have these sort of, you know, parental, familial kind of relationships. So, but I wonder about that. I mean, like you said, they're witnessing the death of a close friend and family member. One guy has been depressed, has contemplated suicide. Now they've kind of refound each other again. It seemed almost rekindled. Now are they planning like that next stage? Is it to, you know, like said, are they parenting now?
They do, or are they just finding another couple to mess around with?
Tobias Lindsay Funke thing. God, these people that have kids after they're going through a rough spot to make their marriage better, it never works out. But it might work out for us.
Yeah, I wonder if, I wonder if it's to have someone else around so that they're not quite so bored. Because it at least Ian brought an element of difference, like something else to them. So I wonder if it's parenting or just having another, like a couple to come over and play bridge or pinochle or whatever.
You have to go for the first 20 years of them being angry at them.
But that's what I'm saying. I mean, I think the thing is with even the idea of vampires in any way, shape, or form, I think there has to be some level of, especially this one, they do seem to be very civilized, where you almost have to have some level of parenting over, you know, over them, teaching them what to do and what not to do, or else they're just going to go around and just, you know, if it's that much of a high they get from blood, they're going to be killing everyone left and right, and you got to be like, hey, you do that and we're going to get found out. So it is kind of that
a
level
risk.
Well, and they also, so do werewolves exist in this world too? Because at that one point where they,
I don't know,
what does she reference, or he references, when they take Ian's body to the parking garage and say something like, he mentioned something about Canis something. She's like, they're tracking you. And he's like, I know.
Well, I kind of miss
it. And then you see kind of like the shapes move in the background of that.
That's a good question. I mean, I think it might just be that wolves are attracted to vampires. Like, I mean, in Stoker's universe, wolves naturally sort of not coalesce, but sort of like we're attracted to, Dracula. Yeah.
Beautiful music or sweet
music?
Sweet music.
But then, like, I did like the idea of like the Detroit is just so poisonous that they just throw them in a water in a parking garage and he's going to disappear.
Yeah, because Kay was like, what is going on there? I was like, I think it's just saying that Detroit is fucking filthy.
And RoboCop's going to find that body. That's all.
He's going to solve that murder and track two vampires,
dead or alive,
two tangiers.
Or undead, you're coming with me.
Alive or undead, that's a good tagline for this episode.
Well, yeah, RoboCop versus the vampires.
RoboCop versus only lovers.
We can write that novel and publish it. We can write that novel and publish it on the Kindle store. Just
do it. Let's do it.
$2.99. Horrible podcast.
Imagine that, like Tom Hiddleston just being like, "What's it all about, RoboCop?" I mean,
dead or unlive, it's about the Prime Directive.
Have you seen the remake?
Are you asking me?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Have you seen the remake, Tyler?
Yes, I saw it in the theater.
Was it good?
No.
I mean, it's not awful. It's really not awful.
Michael Keaton was the strong part of that movie.
The thing is, the first one's a lot... I don't know. I mean, it's going to be hard to compare the two either way. I mean, I thought they did some cool things with the new one, but it's really hard to one-up Paul Verhoeven's ridiculously satirical ultra-violence that when he was doing that with Starship Troopers and Total Recall and RoboCop. I mean, he was really on with that satirical ultra-violent. I mean, it's awesome.
We are living in a day and age where they are actually putting RoboCop statues up in Detroit.
I know. That's awesome.
Yeah. Have you ever seen the site goobingdetroit.tumblr.com?
Mm-mm.
It's just pictures of Google Images and Bing Images of houses over the course of, like, a Google image taken from 2008... of a house in Detroit, another image taken from 2010, and another image taken from 2013. And it's just, it will show one where a house is in a neighborhood, and then the next one, the house is covered in limbs or leaves, and then the next one, the house is burned down. It's super, disturbing and sad to see how Detroit has become the shell of a city.
That's, Detroit seems like maybe the most depressing city ever.
In America.
I mean, the idea that speech he gives about the theater that they're standing under is now a parking garage. That was like a beautiful, ornate
could
thing.
Could seat 4,000 people.
What's that?
I said it could seat 4,000 people. It's beautiful, like so ornate and built on the spot where Henry Ford built his first car, or you know, his first prototype. I mean, it is kind of a love letter to a lost city. And part of me, I love the scenes where they go driving, because those scenes are merely there to show us the sort of like weird, intense energy of that city. And I really dug that.
The the actual idea that, I mean, I think there's some places like Detroit, like they're giving away houses in Detroit.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you could, if you want to go to Detroit, don't get a hotel room, buy a house.
Is that what they say?
Well, I mean, yeah, it's going to cost you less.
You can almost one time I heard that you could buy a city block for like $20,000 in Detroit.
Yeah.
That is absolutely bananas.
I mean, it's bankrupt. It's a bankrupt city.
But it's a city on, like, it's on an ocean. I'm sorry, a body of water. Not an ocean.
Wow.
A great lake. But on a body of water, like, just think about how much property on a body of water around here goes for.
Yeah. Well, the problem is not Detroit. It's the city, like the suburbs around Detroit are doing just fine. People are fleeing Detroit and going to the suburbs, and like they are, like that's why Detroit, that's one of the reasons, main reasons why Detroit is dying, is because people are moving. It would be like if Atlanta died, the suburbs would still be fine. You know,
the suburbs have no comms to soothe the restless dreams of youth. Digga, 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 digga. Yes. That was all. This whole thing was just one big setup for you to mention the suburbs, so I can use Rush's subdivisions.
Subdivisions.
Also, Arcade Fire's The Suburbs. That's also a good album.
That song makes me super sad.
It is.
God, that whole album is sad. It is. It's very. It's basically Only Lovers Left Alive in album.
Yeah. City with No Children.
Don't even get me started on Only Love. Arcade Fire.
I know. Only Fire Left Alive. I mean, I don't know that I have much else. I could just sit and talk about this movie all night. I mean, there's just stuff about it that makes me... This is the kind of movie that makes me wish I could make movies. But like, as far as... It would just be sort of me circling back to the same idea of like, I love the mood. I love the energy of this film. Most movies would be super boring. Most movies made by other filmmakers who are not Jim Jarmusch would be super boring with this pacing and this plot. Yeah. He manages to pull it off and make it interesting.
I think his cast helps a lot too. Yeah. I mean, and I'm not saying you were mm-hmm. not saying that, but I mean, I do think, yeah, Hiddleston and Swinton.
She's so
and
good. Hurt,
and even Yelchin and Wasikowski are just set there. They're such compelling actors. I did just read Fassbender originally was supposed to be.
That makes perfect sense. Yeah. Like, I could totally see Fassbender.
I think I like Hiddleston better though.
Yeah.
I think there's less of a, it's strange, but I mean, I always feel the weird thing about Tom Hiddleston. I feel he's not very masculine, but not in a way that I'm saying that is an insult. Like, it's not that he's feminine. He's just not very. It's why his Loki is so good. Loki doesn't need to be like some macho sort of, I'm gonna kick your ass villain. That's not what he is.
He's like slimy and sneaky, but almost you'd kind of feel for him too. Yeah. Like he has his whole demeanor makes you want to you feel bad for him.
Fassbender exudes a little too much.
What's the movie?
No. I've seen the preview though. It looks entertaining.
What's the movie that that he did where he was a sex addict?
Fassbender?
Yeah. Not Hunger, but the one after, but the
Shameless,
other one.
Shameless, not Steve Shameless. McQueen. Shameful, Shameless, something like that. Yeah, shame, maybe McQueen, it, Shame?
Maybe, yeah, I think it was Shame.
Shame, it is Shame, yeah.
Because they did that, Hunger, and then they did Shame, yeah.
Steve McQueen?
No, this is a British black
guy. Oh, they brought him, I was like, they brought
it's
him
the guy
back?
Who did 12 years as a slave.
Okay, yeah, okay, yeah.
So yeah, like that, even Fassbender's performance in, the Alien movie Prometheus, I thought like was too human in a way. Like it was almost too much, and because he's just so like dude-ish in a way. So like
you're drawn to him. Like anything he does it with such like precision that you know even the. What was
he's
the
magnetic?
He's magnetic. Yeah. What?
Death. If he were in this movie, he would be death magnetic.
What was the movie we watched where he was the resurrected Nazi?
The Wolf Creek, not Wolf Creek.
Creek.
Blood Creek.
Blood Creek, yeah.
Yeah, even that, even in that, he was amazing.
Yeah. Oh, another thing, like, speaking of Tilda Swinton being sort of magnetic, like, the way that she walks in this movie, especially at the end when they get to Tangiers, the way that she was walking there, like, she's totally hungover, was amazing. There was just, her movement in that in the movie is so understated and great. This movie was great to just watch, as opposed to one. Yeah. Like, when we have watched ostensibly plotless movies so far, they have been boring because they were not fun to, like, to watch. They were not fun to just sit and you wanted something to happen. Like, we watched them hoping something would happen, whereas this movie, I didn't care if anything happened or not. I just wanted to see them act. Like, them playing chess was interesting to me.
I think do your acting.
Do some acting. Just act.
When you're talking about the idea earlier of, you know, what's missing in just watching movies at home in the theater, I think this is something that would benefit from being seen in a theater as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think so. I mean,
that
it's just
soundtrack.
Because of how beautiful it is and how well shot it is. I'd like to see it on a large screen, writ large, like it's like it should be.
Well, they played at Cine a month or so ago. So
I came out a bit defensive. I know.
I didn't see it there, but I know.
I know. It was there. Well, guys, Brian, it was there.
I mean, I luckily have a 120-inch Kurt flat screen, so it's kind of like a theater in my house, but whatever.
Well, that was one of the other things we were watching the movie. We were having so much trouble getting it to play. We had a terrible, like, Tyler, when you're talking about the Apple TV, and it would just keep cutting off, and so eventually we were watching it on Gina's phone, and the problem we had there is she keeps her brightness down, and then it took us a few minutes to realize that. It's like, can you cut your brightness up? And she's just like, it's like a whole new movie. Start over. Well, no, fortunately, it was only a few minutes.
It's a movie. This is a movie that if I had happened upon it in my early 20s, I would have watched it a half dozen times by now. Like, when I was in my 20s, this is the kind of movie I was, like, obsessed with watching over and over again.
He would have grown his hair out, and he would have dyed it, and he would have taken on that lifestyle.
I think I'd have fought 1990s Tyler.
This would have been the 2000s. I mean, I'm just saying, this would have been early 2000s. You probably would not have liked it. Like, we wouldn't have gotten along. Early 20s, well,
I don't think he was as beefcake then, were you?
I've always been this size. Like, I'm the...
No, but I mean, you didn't work out and stuff all the time, did you?
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
I want to fight him now.
Drew only came to know me when I was like 24. So, even by then, I had calmed down a fuckload.
Jesus Christ.
As energetic as I am now, I was like a giant douchey ball of energy in my early 20s.
A douchey dervish.
That's exactly.
You must have been really calmed down when I first met you.
Yes.
When we did Blaze of Glory.
Blazing Saddles.
Big Lebowski.
We sang the song together. What was it? Oh,
what is it? It's all the same.
Yeah.
Only the names have changed.
Wanted Dead or Alive.
Wanted Dead or Alive. And the neighbor below was hitting
the broom on the ceiling.
No, I was vastly more calm than I was in my early 20s. I was just a fucking hot mess.
Oof.
Yeah. I'm glad you guys don't know me. Didn't know me then.
If you were Tom Hiddleston, Tyler, I couldn't do it.
Sadly enough, I don't think I have any more or less energy than I had then.
You've always been even keeled. I had to like bottom out or something.
I feel like I'm a lot angrier. I feel like I got a lot of, or not angrier, but just resigned. I'm like, oh, I guess this just is the way life is now.
I mean, you are
either.
Huh?
You don't feel much different either.
Well, great.
You are like a walking Tom Perotta novel. You're just like.
I haven't read any Tom Perotta.
Like, you've seen Election.
Little Children. Like,
okay. The Abstinence Teacher. And
You are a walking Tom Perotta novel. That is for sure. Or like a later Joseph Heller, kind of like Something Happened. Have you ever read that novel?
Something Happened?
Yeah.
No.
You should
only
check
Joseph
it out.
Heller I've ever read is Catch 22.
Catch
22. That's the only Joseph Heller I've ever read.
I think it was his second book, and it took him 10 years to write, but it's about a guy who just lives in the suburbs and fucking hates it, and all he does is complain about his life for an entire book. Like, nothing happens. That's why it's called Something Happened.
I guess I'll just stop complaining now, because that's what it sounded like you just said. Like, all he does is complain about his
no,
life.
No, I'm just saying you would like it. You would sympathize it with it.
I would sympathize. I sympathize with Rush's Subdivisions.
And Arcade Fire is the suburbs. Maybe you're just an Arcade Fire album.
I am a walking embodiment of Arcade Fire albums.
That's a tweet. I am the walking embodiment of Arcade Fire. Post that on Twitter later. I'll like
okay,
it.
I will
I'll
do
star it.
It. The you'll favorite it. The so I guess we're kind of like that's. I mean,
I think we're good.
Yeah,
yeah. I feel good.
We
good?
Don't have to do an hour.
No, we good. This movie is awesome.
Yeah, go see Only Lovers Left Alive.
I say a great movie. I would put this in like our top 10 of movies we've seen. I loved it.
I mean, it's just in a I think it's in a different category. It's just
kind of like Cold in July and like
this is definitely our.
I think it's the best film we've watched, probably.
Artsy. It's definitely our artsiest film, or definitely like concept kind of like film.
I won't say it's my favorite, but it's definitely the best film we've watched.
Sure.
Yeah.
I would say
that. But it's in a different place. It's in a different tier than what most everything else we looked at.
We are broadening the. Kate actually said, I kind of like that you guys are broadening the horizons a little bit. So I was like, yeah, me too. I kind of like that we're doing some different things.
Next
we got to dirty it up.
Cabin Fever.
Yeah, next we're doing Tusk. That movie's going to be dirty and gross. So
like we are saying this on the heels of having watched a movie that was completely in a sewer.
Yeah.
That's right. Yes, you're right. The we're watching Tusk and making all sorts of Fleetwood Mac references.
You will.
You've already made the one.
Well, I'm going to do it over and over again. We're going to have to change the opening song for that week.
I don't think we've got Fleetwood Mac's approval.
I don't think it matters.
I might.
I think it matters enough.
The so guys, hey, just one last thing. If you were thinking about doing something Halloween, come to the Frightening Ass Film Festival 4 in Chattanooga. We're showing the Babadook. We're showing the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 40th anniversary.
Yeah.
And we're showing the Demon's Rook. We're also showing. I'm sorry. We're also at the band SoCro and White Reaper. So we'll get some rap.
SoCro is really good live, like as a rapper. As far as rappers go, he's an awesome
high energy. And some sweet-ass garage music. So,
he's also fun to follow on on social media because he's always posting pictures of himself in like jean shorts in a weird location. And he's all Eastern European and shit, so it's awesome.
So SoCro, he's from Croatia, so he's from the South Tennessee and Croatia, so Southern Croatian SoCro.
I'm thinking Sam Crow for a little bit.
Sam Crow. Yeah,
that's what I thought the first two times was mentioned.
Like, oh my God, this is a rapper that only does Sons of Anarchy songs. This is
that show has good a soundtrack.
Guys, I guess we found our new calling. So anyways, I'm Brian.
I'm Tyler.
And I'm Drew.
And thanks for listening. We'll see you guys next time.
What is our post-episode banter going to be tonight?
I don't appreciate you guys cutting me off.
I did not cut you off. You're like,
Nobody's cutting me off.
You know what I think's funny is that I'd started to bring the music up, and you just kept sputtering like, bah, bah,
like bah. I've listened this long. Tyler's got a book.
Yeah. I was going to bring it up. I already plotted out a fight in our head. In my head about mentioning the book, and I hear you going, "Don't mention that. I'm gonna cut this out. Don't mention that." And I was gonna say, "Oh, and here's how the fight was gonna go. It was gonna go, hey, Tyler's got a book, guys. Keep a lookout for it, Boogie House." And then you're like, "Hey, I wouldn't really mention that." And I was like, "Oh, really? Because social media would say fucking otherwise." And then it'd be a slam, and I wouldn't be able to shut down Skype fast enough. I'd be like, "Fuck."
It'll be ready by Christmas. I have to finish formatting it and get it ready. So
sweet cover.
Thanks, man. I did that.
I read that Kate, you guys took that picture in Bathsheba.
Beersheba, yeah. it's just a burnt down meth house. So
nice.
Kind of fits the theme of the book.
Boogie House.
And my friend of the podcast, Tommy, is he's working on a cover. He's a digital designer, so he's working on a cover using that picture.
I hope he gives you the same kind of quality as Iron Maiden virtual factor. What was the one that was like a bad Photoshop?
Virtual X or whatever?
Virtual X. Go look that up.
I'll have to look that up.
I don't know, it was like VH1 Metal thing. They talked about the Iron Maiden covers and that. It was like, what the fuck was someone thinking when they made this? It's like someone had just got a job with Photoshop and put everything together.
Wasn't that that was Blaze. That was a Blaze album. Blaze.
Oh, you're right. That was. It wasn't.
What is he? Blaze Baxley or something?
Blaze Foley.
That's not that.
Did you find it, Tyler?
My internet's not working. I don't know how we're able to Skype. My internet's not, like, the internet will not pull up. What? How is that happening?
I don't, it's magic. Oh, 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 it's magic.
Pilot.
You know, never believe it's not so.
That was, we did some harmonies there. That did not quite hit that one.
Work on that.
Well, it cut out. It was cutting out. You guys must
We'll be working on Tusk.